Hi, I'm Chuck Seckinger, and welcome to Labor Relation Gigs in Small Bites. In this podcast, we will concentrate on the union construction market and explain all you need to know to understand the labor relations practices that are so unique to this industry. And we'll do it one step at a time in small bites. So let's go. Welcome to episode 3 of Labor Relation Gigs in Small Bites. I'm going to be talking about collective bargaining agreements and PLAs in the construction industry and what it is all about. Let's start with a definition of collective bargaining. Collective bargaining is defined as the continuous relationship between an employer and a designated labor organization representing a specific unit of employees for the purpose of negotiating written terms of employment. A legal definition for collective bargaining will be found in the National Labor Relations Act, Section 8D, which defines collective bargaining as the performance of legal obligations of the employer and the representatives of the employees to meet at reasonable times and confer in good faith with respect to wages, hours, and other terms and conditions of employment, or the negotiation of an agreement to any question arising thereunder, and the execution of a written contract incorporating any agreement reached if requested by either party, but such obligations does not compel either party to agree to a proposal or require the making of a concession. These definitions give you a foundation of what I will be talking about in this episode when I refer to collective bargaining and collective bargaining agreements. In the construction industry, this means all of the following. Local agreements negotiated between a specific building trades local union and a contractor or contractor association, or a national labor agreement negotiated by an international union or unions and a major engineering construction firm or a national contractor association for use anywhere in the U.S., or a project labor agreement, or PLA for short, negotiated by a certain number of unions and contractors for a specific project. All of the above can broadly fit under the definition of collective bargaining agreement, or CBA for short. As I mentioned in Episode 1, under the National Labor Relations Act, a CBA in the construction industry falls under Section 8F, which allows for the contractors and unions to negotiate a labor agreement before a bargaining unit has been established. These 8F pre-hire agreements are unique to the construction industry because of the short-term nature of construction projects and the need to have some level of cost certainty before the project is started. Again, as I mentioned in Episode 1, only companies and unions engaged in the construction industry can negotiate these pre-hire agreements. All other bargaining under the NLRA would fall under Section 9A, where a bargaining unit must be established and have a demonstrated show of interest by 30% of employees signing union authorization cards in that bargaining unit in favor of the union, and an NLRB union certification election where the union is voted in by over 50%. Examples of Section 9A bargaining are typical in manufacturing and service industries, where employees are not union members when they start their employment, but are required under a union shop agreement to become members after 30 days if there is already a collective bargaining agreement in play at the workplace. Typically, a good way to identify a 9A labor agreement is to identify that there is a requirement for union membership after 30 days, considering that it is a union shop agreement. If there is a condition in the CBA that requires a new hire employee to become a union member within 8 days from the start of the employment, then you can presume that it is a construction industry pre-hire NLRA 8F labor agreement. Let's first look at what I have called local agreements. These are pre-hire agreements that are negotiated by one union with either one employer or multi-employers through a contractor association. The local union will inform the employer or contractor organization at least 60 days before the expiration of the current CBA that they would like to negotiate modifications to the current labor agreement. This could just be to negotiate increases to wages and benefits or for substantial language changes to the existing conditions of the CBA. The two parties will then find a mutual time, date, and place to engage in negotiation, prepare their research to defend or advance their position, and form their bargaining strategies. As was noted before, neither party is required to make a concession, but each is obligated to bargain in good faith over the terms of contract negotiations. This means the parties must make an honest and genuine effort to find middle ground that benefits both the union and management. Local CBA agreements are anywhere between 2 to 3 years in duration and define all the employment conditions of the bargaining union, that is, the members of the union who are employees of a signatory employer. The primary economic conditions of the CBA are wage rates in the classification described in the labor agreement, such as journeyman, foreman, general foreman, apprentices, and some specialty classifications, for example, such as welders, certified crane operators, or wire splicers. Also, hours of work, shift work, overtime conditions, lunch and break periods are all part of the economic conditions of the CBA. Economic conditions in the CBA are the fringe benefits that come with being an employed member of the union. The CBA will detail the amount an employer must contribute to the individual employee's health and welfare fund, pension and annuity plan, training funds, along with funds for drug testing, labor management cooperation, and many other variations based upon the local bargainer's priorities in their local construction market. As far as calculating the dollar value of the total package of wages and benefits per hour for each hour worked, the contractor would first take the union classification straight time rate and then add each employer contribution to employee benefits and any other funds such as labor management funds and total up the amount to get what is known as the total package cost per hour. Consider the contractor will also want to know the total package costs for each union classifications for an overtime hour of work at time 1/2 and double time. This will require a careful reading of the union CBA to detail how their benefits are calculated either on the basis of hours worked or hours paid. The hours worked employer contribution to the employee benefits would mean that each individual benefit contribution is paid at the regular straight time rate, even if the employee works past 40 hours for the week. In other words, for the 41st hour of work in the work week, the total package cost of the overtime hour worked by the employee would equal the straight time wage rate times 1 1/2 plus the straight time cost of all employer contributions to employee benefits. That some CBAs call for employer contributions to employee benefits be paid at an hours paid calculation. That would mean, for the sake of example again, the 41st hour worked would be paid at the classification straight time rate times 1 1/2 plus all employer contributions to the employee benefit funds would also be paid at time and 1/2 rate, so that the total package cost for overtime hour would equal the straight time rate times 1 1/2 plus all benefit contributions at times 1 1/2. The same logic would apply for a double time hour. This would make a big difference to the contractor's estimate when the project is scheduled for substantial overtime hours. The accurate total package wage for each union's classification must be reported and added to the final order of value bid estimate to have a solid number to submit with a level of confidence in its accuracy. Without this detail, the contractor may lose money when it comes to the execution of work on overtime over the term of the project's duration. Another important condition to understand in a CBA is hours of work. the configuration of the workday and the workweek, and how overtime is calculated for the shift work. Most construction CBAs will define that a workday can start at 7 a.m. and run for 8 hours of continuous work, but including a 30-minute unpaid lunch period in the middle of the shift so that the total duration of the workday is 8 hours and 30 minutes. Those 8 hours of work time are the straight time hours for that workday. In this example, with 7 a.m. as a start time, the regular workday would end at 3:30 p.m. However, for any time worked by an employee either before or after those regularly scheduled work hours, they would be paid as overtime at time on 1/2. This would be for work performed Monday through Friday on a 5-day, 8-hour work week. Once this work week is completed, it becomes an established shift, which sets the regular working hours and straight time pay requirements for subsequent work weeks. If the contractor wanted to change the work hours to a different start time, say 8 a.m., the project manager would have to give at least 3 to 5 day notice to the union and the project employees, depending upon the requirements of the CBA, for notice to change the shift hours of an established shift. To establish a shift other than the regular workday hours, the employer would give at least 3 day notice to the union that it would be establishing a second shift or night shift, declare the start time, the lunch and quit times, and then keep the new shift running for at least 3 to 5 days, depending upon the CBA's requirements. A shift premium for working the night shift would apply if noted in the CBA. This shift premium would be based on a percentage over the straight time rate, for example, 10%, or it could be based on a dollar figure like $2 per hour added to the straight time rate, or even by shortening the work hours of the shift to 7 1/2 hours worked on second shift for 8 hours pay, or 7 hours worked for 8 hours pay on the third shift. Another work week and shift hours configuration offered in many local CBAs and other national agreements is the 4-day, 10-hour work week. Under this configuration, the work week would start Monday and run through Thursday, and the regular work day would be for 10 hours a day instead of 8 hours. This would mean that any work before the regular start time and any work after the 10-hour workday would be considered overtime and paid at time and 1/2. Under this 4-day and 10-hour per day work week, the employer may use Friday as a makeup day if work cannot be performed Monday through Thursday due to inclement weather or any conditions beyond the employer's control. Again, the CBA would define the conditions of the makeup day, such as being paid at straight time rate or overtime rate, and if the employees were on a mandatory assignment to work the makeup day, or it could be on a voluntary basis, all depending upon the language of the CBA. In some CBAs, the makeup day can be called by the employer on weeks when a project holiday is celebrated during a workday to make up for the 40 straight time hours worked during the week. On all configured work weeks, overtime must be paid after the employee has worked 40 straight time hours in an established work week as per the Fair Labor Standards Act. It is important to remember that statutory law concerning employment conditions cannot be bargained away in collective bargaining. Another unique economic wage condition in construction local agreements and national agreements is called reporting pay. Again, it is unique to construction because the nature of the work is primarily performed outside in all types of weather conditions. When there is threat of inclement weather may halt or delay construction activities planned for the day, employees will need an incentive to drive to work or take public transportation that day, only to be told that work is canceled for the day. To cover the employee's travel costs, many CBAs will require the employer to pay 2 hours to the employees for showing up ready for work on one of those iffy weather days. However, the employee must remain on site and ready to work within those 2 hours unless excused by supervision and told they are no longer required to stay on site to be paid the 2 hours. If the employee starts work, the CBA may require a 4-hour minimum pay to the employee that starts work but is excused for the day by supervision after starting work and working less than 4 hours. Some agreements may call for just actual time work to be paid to the employee after they have started work and continued on past the first 2 hours of the shift. You will see in most CBAs, there is no guaranteed 40-hour pay, with the exception of the operating engineer CBAs, where the employer is required to pay their equipment operators on a weekly 40-hour basis. These are based with certain conditional exceptions like midweek hire-in dates, layoffs, and voluntary time off. The unique economic condition in the construction labor agreements, and especially ones that cover ongoing plant maintenance, is the call-out pay provision. This works something like the reporting pay. However, call-out pay would be in effect if the employee is called at home to come back to work after the completion of their shift or on the weekend due to the emergent need of a project or within the operating plant. There are various incentives like guaranteed 4 hours pay for responding, lunch allowance pay, or a guaranteed 8 hours after working at least 4 hours. Finally, the last unique overtime pay condition that I will mention is the work through lunch or eat on the fly and second lunch period pay provisions. The work through lunch, or sometimes called WTL for short, is also known as eating on the fly, would come in effect when the employee is directed by supervision to forego their regular 30-minute unpaid lunch period because of emergent work or to finish work tasks that cannot be put on hold for 30 minutes because of imminent danger to life and property, or simply to keep on schedule. When the employee is told to continue to work during this established lunch period and does not get a full 30 minutes of rest, then for forgoing their personal time, they are paid 1/2 hour at overtime. The employee may take some personal time during this time period to eat something or to take a short bio break, but they are considered to be on duty and ready for assignment. The important point to remember is that the WTL can only be authorized by supervision and not by a member of the bargaining unit like a general foreman, foreman, or steward. The second lunch overtime pay requirement can usually be found in local national agreements. It is used when the employer calls for extended unscheduled mandatory overtime after the regular work hours are over for the shift. Since this work has great urgency and was unplanned, the employees are afforded a second lunch period, usually at the beginning of the 11th consecutive hour of work for the shift. In many local agreements, the employer is required to pay for the rest period on company time and provide an allowance for lunch money or provide a hot meal for the employees. Construction CBAs will most likely list at least 7 major holidays for the year, starting with New Year's Day, Memorial Day, July 4th, Labor Day, Thanksgiving Day and the day after, and Christmas Day. Some will add MLK Day, President's Day, Federal Election Day, Veterans Day, and depending on what part of the country you're in, you might see Mardi Gras, Bunker Hill Day, or even VJ Day. The surprising thing is that in the union construction industry, all of these annual holidays are unpaid to the employee. Some local agreements set up a forced savings account for vacation pay, which is funded on employee deductions and can only be drawn upon on certain months of the year. A standard for most local agreements is that any work performed on holidays will be paid at a double time rate, and work on Labor Day is prohibited except for emergencies. A couple more unique terms that you might see in local CBAs are the phrases no pyramiding of overtime and me too, appearing as references in overtime provisions. What does pyramiding of overtime mean? Well, it means that you can't add overtime premiums to other premiums to come up with a total wage greater than double time rate of the straight time rate. As far as Me Too clause, some local agreements will require the payment of overtime or double time when any other union working on the project is making a higher rate. In other words, if iron workers are working at a double time rate and the operating engineers have a Me Too clause in their CBA, that would mean that the operating engineers would get double time also for providing services to the iron workers. I mention these terms just so you have an understanding of their meaning. And again, they are very unique to the construction pre-hire labor agreements. Let's move on to another type of collective bargaining agreement that is used frequently in the industrial construction and maintenance industry. These are what are called national agreements, which are negotiated between one union or a number of unions, if not all building trade unions, and a group of national engineering and construction firms that are part of a contractors association or form a coalition because of their common interest in a certain type of construction work. Here are the names of the most frequently used national agreements in the U.S. union construction market. Number one, the National Construction Agreement, or the NCA, used primarily for greenfield industrial construction projects, such as fossil power plants, manufacturing centers, refineries, or any other industrial new build. Number two, the General President's Project Maintenance Agreement, or the GPPMA for short. The primary use of this agreement is maintenance, as its name portends, and most commonly for nuclear outage maintenance and modification work at U.S. nuclear plants. Number three, the National Maintenance Agreement, or NMA. Again, primarily used as a maintenance agreement in the fossil power, steel, and automobile industries. However, it has been used recently for new construction, like solar field power projects. Number four, the Heavy and Highway Agreement, used as you might think for roadways, bridges, airports, dams and locks, and other major infrastructure projects. The Heavy and Highway Agreement has been underutilized over the some 20 years waiting for the major infrastructure bill that has just passed by Congress and signed by President Biden. You should expect to hear more about this labor agreement in the future in regards to the federally funded construction projects under Davis-Bacon prevailing wage requirements. This is such an important topic that I will be posting another episode on infrastructure and Davis-Bacon in the near future. Number five, the National Wind Turbine Agreement. As you might guess, this agreement is used for on-land construction of wind turbine power projects that have been sprouting up all over the American landscape. After almost 20 years of construction firms negotiating a dozen different labor agreements for wind power projects, the unions and the contractors got together in 2020 to create a common agreement that provides for an even playing field for the bidding process and standardizes working conditions for this work all over the country. If you are wanting to know more about these national agreements, they are all readily available on the internet. You can find the NCA and the GPPMA on the NAB2 website, nab2.org, under the Field Services tab, along with interpretation bulletins. The NMA can be accessed on the National Maintenance Policy Committee's website, www.nmapc.org. The National Maintenance Agreements are individual labor agreements with all of the 14 building trades unions. The base NMA agreements are all nearly identical in their definition of work conditions. Also, the NMAPC website has the Book of Decisions, which again details the interpretation of the NMA over the years that it has been in use. The Heavy and Highway Agreement, or its more complete name, the National Infrastructure Alliance Heavy and Highway Construction Project Agreement, can be found at www.niabuilds.org. The National Wind Turbine Agreement, or the NWTA, is a more recently signed labor agreement, and the contractors that are signatory have not formed a contractors association to date to support and administer it. For now, the NWTA is available through the signatory unions, which are the United Brotherhoods of Carpenter, the IBEW Electricians, Liona Laborers, Ironworkers, and the Operating Engineers International Offices. What are the purpose of these national agreements? Well, the intent of the contractors and unions are to build a labor agreement for specific and recurring industrial construction projects and have that labor agreement up on the shelf where it can be used by the parties as needed without recreating the wheel for every project. A national contractor would apply for these agreements using a standardized new project form and get their application to the international unions, who will then ballot their application amongst themselves and also get input from the local unions having geographical jurisdiction over where the project will be built. After a period of 10 days to 2 weeks, the contractor will be advised by the international reps of the status of their application for approval. Some of these national agreements come with a usage cost over the term of the project or a one-time upfront fee, and some do not have a fee at all. These national agreements are in effect from the moment the contractor is advised of approval of their application up to the end of substantial construction and commissioning. The implementation process is very efficient on the international union's part and works well to establish a labor agreement quickly for the contractors where mobilization is imminent. These prefabricated national agreements do not fit every circumstance in the industrial construction market. Some projects are so unique, are spread out over many geographical areas, have very lengthy durations to completion, involve a number of governmental agencies and municipalities or private investors, that it takes a special one-of-a-kind construction pre-hire ADEF labor agreement needed to satisfy all of the project stakeholders, from the public's interest, government or shareholders' fiduciary responsibilities, and the union's interest in the construction market share. These types of projects are large, complicated, expensive, take many of the community's resources to complete, and ultimately add value through employment opportunities and quality of life enhancements, such as speedier transportation, cleaner waterways, or spawning new capital investments. These types of projects require a project labor agreement that satisfies the project's foundational need for cost certainty and expeditious completion. Some typical examples of PLA projects are generally to be found in the public sector. The Boston Harbor Cleanup Project and the Big Dig that buried underground major artery traffic running through the city of Boston are good examples of public sector PLAs. Also, more examples would be the Tappan Zee Bridge rebuild over the Hudson River in New York, and more recently, a number of offshore wind turbine projects to be built on the northeast coast of the Atlantic Ocean will have negotiated PLAs to ensure cost certainty, community involvement, and on-time completion. Who is negotiating project labor agreements? It usually starts with the state or local building trades council that are following the local news and construction permitting process to detail major projects coming to their jurisdiction. From there, the developers or owners will commit to local labor organizations their intent to have awarded contractors build the project using a union workforce. However, in most cases, the contractors that will be awarded work on a project are still in the bidding process and will be determined at a later date. In the meantime, NAPTU has authority over all the local building trade councils, and a PLA negotiated at the local level must meet certain criteria established by NAPTU, or it will not be approved for implementation. The basic five articles that NAPTU require to be defined in any PLA are the following. First, a clear, defined scope of work. What is being built? Where and how this work fits into traditional building trades jurisdiction. Second, a disputes and grievance resolution procedure to settle interpretation issues and disciplinary matters. Third, a procedure to resolve jurisdictional disputes that may arise during the course of construction. Most likely the plan, as I described in episode 2, will be used. However, some work scopes may not be considered to be traditional construction building trades jurisdiction, such as tunneling work or electrical power distribution. The important point here is that any and all issues that arise during the project's construction must be provided a disputes resolution forum so that no particular unresolved dispute can result in a work stoppage. Fourth, a subcontracting clause that allows contractors to sub out part of the scope to other lower-tier contractors, but binds those contractors to the conditions of the PLA through a letter of assent, which requires them to comply regardless if the contractor is a union or non-union contractor prior to being awarded work on the project. And fifth, the PLA must have a provision binding all contractors to pay into the NAPTU Helmets to Hard Hats Fund, which is administered to bring recent veterans into the union building trades apprenticeship programs. How do PLAs work? Well, a PLA, as well as a national agreement, are called standalone labor agreements. By that is meant that the PLA is separate from the union's local CBA in that it creates a unique bargaining unit comprised of only the employees working on the project that the PLA covers. It is still a NLRA 8F pre-hire construction agreement, but it knits together specific working terms and conditions that prevail over the ones appearing in the union's local CBA. For example, overtime may be calculated more favorably to the contractor in the PLA because of a project's compressed schedule that would make the normal shift duration of 10 or even 12-hour shift. Let's say the union's local CBA calls for time and one half after 8 hours and double time after 10 hours Monday through Friday. However, the contractors are planning for a 12-hour daily shift to meet schedule and have negotiated the 12 hours to be worked at 8 hours straight time and plus 4 hours at time and one half. The provisions of the PLA will prevail over any local conditions as the parties would agree to in negotiations due to the sheer volume of work hours the project would present. A PLA can attach the local CBA to the PLA as a Schedule A, and depending on negotiations, the individual local CBA's wages and benefits, apprenticeship, and hiring all provisions can be used as the controlling terms and conditions of the PLA if the PLA is silent on these specific provisions. More importantly, the PLA should standardize the hours of work so shifts can be coordinated for a large project. Other economic conditions such as overtime, holiday, reporting pay should all be included in the PLA to, again, have a better definition of cost certainty. On public sector PLAs, it is not unusual to have community hiring requirements calling for a certain percentage of craft workers to be hired from specific zip codes in the metropolitan area. Underrepresented groups such as minorities and women in the construction industry could have overall hiring goals for the project set in the PLA. There is a lot more to learn about construction industry collective bargaining agreements and PLAs. This episode only covers the tip of the iceberg. The best way to learn about labor agreements is to read through them and try to identify the key provisions, like, does it have a clear and prohibitive language regarding work stoppages, grievance procedures, and jurisdictional dispute resolutions? All of these provisions are important to keep the project working. If a dispute or even a work stoppage occurs, you will want to know how to handle it correctly and stay within the requirements of the labor agreement. Remember that a labor agreement must provide a forum for all disputes and interpretations to be handled, or the contractor will find that in the event of a work stoppage over an issue that is not covered in the labor agreement, it could hamper their efforts to gain injunctive relief to disband or limit picketing. Some more important provisions of the CBA or PLA are the Articles of Management Rights and Job Rules, or AKA Discipline. So important are these provisions to keep the project moving in a positive direction. I will be covering them in the next episode, Management's Rights, Discipline, and the Grievance Procedure. Until then, I hope you have learned the basic of construction collective bargaining agreements and PLAs. I hope that you will join me in the next episode. Until then, be safe and be kind. Reference for this episode 3, a paper, Developments in Collective Bargaining and Construction in the 1980s and 90s, by Stephen G. Allen, North Carolina University and National Bureau of Economic Research, May 1993. A paper, Building Better, Providing Value in Construction Through Best Practices in Project Labor Agreements, by Dale Billman, Michigan State University, School of Labor and Industrial Relations, and Matthew M. Buda, University of Rhode Island, Schmidt Labor Research Center. A paper, Fundamentals of Collective Bargaining, Module 1, Introduction to Collective Bargaining, by the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, A Participant's Guide. And finally, a pamphlet, A Guide to Basic Law and Procedures Under the National Labor Relations Act, by the National Labor Relations Board, U.S. Government Printing Office. I'm Chuck Seckinger, Principal Consultant with Labor Relations Gigs. You can find more episodes at www.laborrelationgigs.com. Thank you for listening. Bye. We'll be right back.